Before we get into the text before us today, I want to offer just a brief explanation of why we are skipping chapter 753 through 811. The ESV translation is representative of the general scholarly consensus. By putting this passage in brackets and with the explanation, the earliest manuscripts do not include John 753 through 811. And the fact is, we have a tremendous manuscript evidence for the Gospel of John, including a complete manuscript from about the year 200. And yet this passage does not appear in any manuscripts of John before the 5th or the 6th century. And then when it does appear, it actually shows up in different places, a couple different places in John, and actually sometimes in the book of Luke. And all of that shows that this is likely a later insertion into the gospel record. It's also a story. The story of Jesus and the adulteress is not mentioned by any of the early church fathers until about the 5th century. And it seems to break the flow of the narrative, as we'll see. What we pick up here today follows very smoothly from what we read last week. And that is not to say that the story of Jesus and the woman caught in adultery is not a historical fact. It's not that it's not necessarily true, but it doesn't seem that it was part of the original Gospel of John, and that's what we want to be working through in this sermon series. And so we are going to skip this and go directly to what seems to have been the next part of the narrative as John originally wrote it. Now, last week we saw Jesus at the Feast of Tabernacles as he declared, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink." And we noted how the water ritual at the feast provided the perfect backdrop for Jesus' statement. That ritual in which priests carried water from the spring of Gihon and poured it on the altar had several levels of meaning. On the natural level, it pointed to a prayer for rain to come and end the season of drought that they experienced each year at that time. On the redemptive historical level, that level of God's unfolding plan of salvation for his people, it looked both backwards and forwards. It looked back to the time of Israel's wilderness sojourn that was celebrated in the Feast of Tabernacles. Yahweh had brought water from the rock to quench the thirst of the Israelites. And the water ritual also looked forward to the fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy that a day would come when living waters would flow out of Jerusalem. And ultimately, it looked forward to the heavenly Jerusalem descending to the new earth at the time of Jesus' final coming, when the river of the water of life would flow forth from the throne of the Lamb. In various ways, all these levels of meaning pointed to Jesus as the great quencher of spiritual thirst, past, present, and future. Now, in addition to the water ritual, an elaborate light ceremony had been incorporated into the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles in Jerusalem in Jesus' day. Here is one scholar's description of the scene that pilgrims would encounter at the temple each night during the feast. "Four large stands each held four golden bowls, which were placed in the heavily used court of the women. These 16 golden bowls, which were reached by ladders, were filled with oil, and for wicks they floated in them the knotted, worn undergarments of the priest. When they were lit at night," the rabbi said, "all Jerusalem was illumined. In a world that did not have public lighting after dusk, this light shining from Jerusalem's yellow limestone walls must have been spectacular. Choirs of Levites sang during the lighting, while men of piety and good works danced in the court of the women, carrying torches and singing hymns." Now, you can imagine, that surely would have been a memorable experience. The four giant lampstands were taller than the walls of the temple, so that the light flowed out over the entire city. And as with the water ritual, this light ceremony had several levels of meaning. On a purely natural level, the Feast of Tabernacles coincided with the autumn equinox, when the length of the day and the night were exactly the same. And moving forward on the calendar, the days would be shorter, less light, and the nights would be longer. And the ritual at the feast celebrated the light before it began to wane. On the redemptive historical level, the nighttime light ceremony looked back to the time of the wandering in the wilderness again, when the Israelites were led by a pillar of fire by night. And remember what was happening in this feast. The pilgrims had come. They were living in booths, replicating the experience of their forefathers, remembering what it was like to be in the wilderness. And just as their forefathers saw that pillar of fire at night, they saw these great fires that were lit on the lampstands in Jerusalem. Light imagery was important to the forward-looking of the vision of the Old Testament prophets as well. Isaiah evoked images from the Exodus when he prophesied of the coming day when the branch of the Lord would be glorified. We read in Isaiah 4:5, "Then Yahweh will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night." Last week, we recalled Zechariah's prophecy of the future as it related to the water ritual. "In that day it shall be that living water shall flow from Jerusalem." Well, just one verse prior to that, we read of the time when there will be neither day nor night, but at evening time it shall happen that it will be light. So at the level of redemptive history, the light ceremony of Jerusalem looked both backwards and it looked forwards. And with all that in mind, let's get into our text. We begin with verse 12 of John chapter 8. "Then Jesus spoke to them, saying, 'I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life.'" And here Jesus is still in the temple during the Feast of Tabernacles. Was it nighttime? Were the lamps burning, brightly illuminating all Jerusalem as he spoke? Well, we don't know for certain, but surely that nightly ritual of light was on the minds of the pilgrims. And it's in that context that Jesus declares, "I am the light of the world." And we want to consider this statement from a few angles. First of all, note that it employs the language of the divine name, "I am." We saw in chapter 6 how Jesus used this language that the Lord had used to reveal himself to Moses when Jesus said in John 6, "I am the bread of life." And when Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," it is the second of 7 times in the Gospel of John when Jesus says, "I am," and then there's a blank to fill in. And each of these statements is a statement of identity with God, the great I am, as well as a revelation of Jesus' character and mission. And here, that mission is described in terms of illumination, of enlightening. Jesus says, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." When the lamps on the 4 giant lampstands were lit each night during the Feast of Tabernacles, all Jerusalem was illumined. But Jesus claims to be greater than this. He is not just the light for Jerusalem. He is the light of the world. As readers of John's Gospel, these words send us back to the prologue in chapter 1. John the Baptizer is introduced as one who came to bear witness of the light. And then we read, beginning at chapter 1, verse 9, "That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him." John 8, with its conflict between Jesus and the Jewish leaders that's going to dominate this chapter, is almost a commentary on these verses from chapter 1. Jesus is indeed the true light, and he is the light not just for a few, but for everyone, the light of the world. He came into this world for this world. And so the promise is held out. "He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." As Jesus came into a world that was dominated by spiritual thirst, so he came into a world dominated by spiritual darkness. Just as Jesus brought living water to a thirsty world, so he brings the light of life to a dark world. And our day is just like Jesus in this regard. Many people are walking in spiritual darkness. They are making their way through life with no spiritual bearings. They lack a sense of purpose that would align themselves with the purpose of God for his creation. They lack a sense of fulfillment because every avenue by which they seek fulfillment fails to satisfy. And most of all, they lack an experience of intimate relationship with God. Children, have you ever played a game where you are blindfolded so that you can't see anything? I remember playing a game and I was blindfolded, and then I was turned around and around and around until I was dizzy, and then I was supposed to start walking around trying to find people. Well, what do you think I did? I staggered all over the place, falling down, bumping into things, and only really by accident finding somebody else. Well, what was my problem? Well, I was in darkness. I had no bearings. I had no idea where I was going. And that can be fun in a game, but it isn't fun when it's a description of your life. And that is the description of the lives of many who walk in spiritual darkness because they haven't come to Jesus, the light. They may not even realize the darkness they're in, but they live as those blindfolded to spiritual truth. Now, what is the key to spiritual illumination? Jesus says, "He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." The way to leave spiritual darkness is to come to Jesus in faith and to become one of his followers. The light that he gives is the light of life. That's a rich word in John. It's speaking of true life, of spiritual life, of eternal life, of being drawn into fellowship with the very triune God in this life. You will only find your true purpose in life, you will only find ultimate satisfaction in it, if you seek it by following Jesus. He created you. He knows what is best for you. And he died to make this eternal life available to you. When Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," he is once again claiming to fulfill all the hopes of the Feast of Tabernacles. As the Jews celebrated the sunlight when it was about to wane, so Jesus called them to look to him as the true light that never wanes. As they remembered how the pillar of fire went before their ancestors in the wilderness, so they were to view Jesus as the light going before them, as the one whom they were now to follow. And by the light of Jesus, they could leave spiritual darkness and find true life. Jesus spoke wonderful words of promise, but not everyone was ready to accept them. Verse 13. The Pharisees therefore said to him, "You bear witness of yourself. Your witness is not true." At the end of chapter 7, the Pharisees were among the religious officials who were upset at the temple guards, you know, who had been sent out but who returned not having seized Jesus. And one of the number of the Pharisees, Nicodemus, had called for justice and fairness in the matter, but they didn't heed his voice, and now they speak out against Jesus to his face. Their claim is that Jesus' testimony can't be true because he is bearing witness about himself. Now, one thing to note here is the judicial terminology in this account. We can see words like witness and testimony. It's the language of the courtroom. And their complaint seems to be rooted in the requirement of God's law for a minimum of two witnesses in criminal proceedings. So, for example, we read in Deuteronomy 19:15, "One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established." Now, think about what the Pharisees' appeal to this principle reveals about their view of Jesus. This requirement of the law applied to criminal trials, not to everything anybody said. Moses didn't need a second witness to speak truth from God. Isaiah, Jeremiah, and the other prophets, they didn't need others to back up their prophetic utterances. And what is Jesus doing? He's teaching in the temple, which is hardly a situation in which the rules of evidence come into play. Unless, that is, you, like the Pharisees, view Jesus as veritably a criminal on trial. And this is exactly what we see throughout chapter 8. It's an informal trial of Jesus. While this courtroom language sets the stage for judicial-style proceedings, we'll see that with Jesus' responses, there is sometimes a question as to just who is on trial. And that response begins in the next verse, verse 14. Jesus answered and said to them, "Even if I bear witness of myself, my witness is true. For I know where I came from and where I am going, but you do not know where I come from and where I am going." Now, Jesus does not concede to their argument for multiple witnesses. He replies, "Even if I bear witness of myself, my witness is true." And to back up that claim, he adds, "For I know where I came from and where I am going." Now, you may recall that Jesus' origin has been a matter of debate at the feast. Some had rejected Jesus because they said they knew where he came from, and when the Messiah comes, we would not know that. They thought the Messiah would have some mysterious origin, and so Jesus didn't fit that bill. On the other hand, there was others who rejected him because he came from Galilee, and they expected the Messiah to come from Bethlehem. And against this background, the background of this debate and confusion about Jesus' origin, he tells the Pharisees, "You do not know where I come from and where I'm going." Now, as readers of John's gospel, we know what the Pharisees don't know. We know that Jesus is the Word made flesh, the eternally begotten Son, come from heaven to earth. That's from where he came. He came from heaven. He came from heaven to earth to fulfill his Father's mission. And what keeps the Pharisees in spiritual darkness is the fact that they refused to acknowledge Jesus' heavenly origin and heavenly mission. And Jesus explains the reason for their failure in this regard, picking up at verse 15. "You judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. And yet if I do judge, my judgment is true, for I am not alone, but I am with the Father who sent me." The Pharisees continue to look at things according to the flesh. And in this, they are like many modern secular people who refuse even to acknowledge a transcendent realm. And while the Pharisees did not deny the supernatural, they did refuse to accept Jesus' claims to a supernatural origin and mission. Their judgment was not according to the spirit and the heavenly, it was of the flesh and earthly. And they were experts in such judgment, often evaluating fellow Jews on the basis of how well they kept the man-made laws that the Pharisees promoted. Jesus draws a sharp contrast between the Pharisees, who judge according to the flesh, and himself when he says, "I judge no one." Now, that sounds odd, since we know that Jesus is involved in judgment. In fact, he's going to go on here and to say that that's the case. But he doesn't engage in judging as the Pharisees do. And the core of his mission was not to bring judgment, but to bring salvation. Recall how Jesus described his mission to Nicodemus in chapter 3, verse 17. "For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world." And that word "condemn" is the very same word in Greek that we find here in chapter 8 as "judge." He didn't come into the world to judge the world, but the world through him might be saved. So on the one hand, when judgment is viewed according to the way the Pharisees judged, Jesus didn't judge at all. He is no cosmic legalist. However, Jesus doesn't deny involvement with judgment so long as it is understood to be rooted in his unity with the Father. He says, "And yet if I do judge, my judgment is true, for I am not alone who judge, but I am with the Father who sent me." And what's more, Jesus stresses his unity with the Father who sent him. And it is this unity that assures the truthfulness of his judgment. And the implication here is that the judgment of the Pharisees is not true. And Jesus now returns to that charge that he alone bore witness to himself, verses 17 and 18. It is also written in your law that the testimony of two men is true. I am one who bears witness of myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness of me. It is as if Jesus says here, okay, I'll play the game on your terms. Your law says that there must be two witnesses, so I'll give you two witnesses. I'm witness number one, and the Father who sent me is witness number two. And to that, the Pharisees have a quick response. Then they said to him, where is your Father? And clearly, they're thinking according to the fleshly and the earthly. They're thinking in terms of a criminal trial. They are the prosecution. The defense says that they have a witness, so they want the defense to produce the witness. You say your Father's a witness, so where is he? Let's get him on the stand to testify. We continue in verse 19. Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. So now who is on trial? The Pharisees would like to think that they are sitting in judgment of Jesus, but he is responding with judgment on them. You know neither me nor my Father. And of course, claiming that the Pharisees didn't know God was a serious charge indeed, and one sure to offend them if they understood what Jesus was saying. The Pharisees think they know Jesus. Indeed, based on their evaluation of him, they are ready to have him judged and executed. But they don't really know Jesus. And it is their lack of knowledge about him that leads to their lack of knowledge about his Father. And this is another consistent theme in John's gospel. Jesus has come to reveal God the Father. And the only way to know the Father is through Jesus. Remember again, all the way back in chapter 1, John tells us, no one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him. You cannot be in a right relationship with God if you reject Jesus. It isn't possible because Jesus is God the Father's appointed means of revealing himself. If you write Jesus off, you can't possibly have fellowship with God. The Pharisees had written Jesus off, and he is informing them of the consequences. Now, you might think that the Pharisees would have had enough, and that now that they were face to face with Jesus, they would just arrest him. But John gives us another editorial comment. You know, he does that from time to time here in verse 20. These words Jesus spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one laid hands on him, for his hour had not yet come. The hour of Jesus' death is approaching, but it is not here yet. His mission is unfolding according to a divine timetable, and no human being is going to disrupt it. Because God has other plans, no one arrests Jesus at this point. John also tells us where this is taking place. These words Jesus spoke in the treasury. The treasury was a chamber adjoining the court of the women. Now, Jesus wouldn't actually be in the treasury itself. The implication is probably that he was near it, perhaps in the area where people deposited their tithes and their gifts. And this meant that he would be speaking in the vicinity of the four great lampstands whose lamps shed forth light throughout Jerusalem. And this brings us back full circle to the beginning of our passage. So during the Feast of Tabernacles, great lamps were lit at night, accompanied by festive celebration. In the area of the tabernacle and of the temple where this took place, Jesus declared, I am the light of the world. The light emanating from the temple each night of the feast was impressive. But the light emanating from Jesus was more so. It wasn't physical light, but it was the power of spiritual illumination. It was truth that could transfer people from spiritual darkness into spiritual life. And the key to making this liberating transition was to follow Jesus in faith. And that's precisely what the Pharisees do not do. They're conducting an informal trial, though in their minds they've already judged Jesus guilty. They exemplify the rejection of the light spoken of by John in the prologue of his gospel. That was the true light which gives light to every man coming into the world. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. What Jesus explained, but the Pharisees didn't comprehend, was that by rejecting him, they were cutting themselves off from God the Father. They were consigning themselves to remaining in spiritual darkness. And the same is true today of anyone who rejects Jesus' revelation of himself and his Father. Spiritual darkness is life apart from Jesus, and we are surrounded by multitudes who are staggering about in spiritual darkness, whether they realize it or not. But the good news is that Jesus didn't come on a mission of judgment and condemnation. His Father sent him on a mission of salvation, a mission that is still in process. Jesus' message, delivered so powerfully against the backdrop of the light ceremony at the Feast of Tabernacles, remains a true message even today. His words are still words of truth and promise. I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. What a blessing it is to be delivered from the darkness of this present evil age. What a privilege it is to be enlightened and to know true eternal life now. And what do we look forward to? Well, we see the culmination of Jesus' light imagery in John's vision of the New Jerusalem descending to the new earth in Revelation 21. And we read there, the city had no need of the sun or of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. Jesus will be the light of the world for all eternity. Like those men in the temple of old who sang and danced around the great candlesticks, may we celebrate the light of Jesus and all that is ours in him, both now and forever. And may we reflect his light to others, pointing them to Jesus as the only means by which they may escape spiritual darkness and join us as those who, by God's grace, have been brought into the light.